Education Order for Monday, February 19th. And members, thanks for shifting schedules so we have the full committee on hand today. The desire was to have a discussion on three proposals that have to do with requirements for graduation. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2510, House Bill 2046, and House Bill 2045. I'm looking forward to discussion both from the members of the committee and from the public in terms of how these requirements might add to the education that our students receive, but also what the impact it is on the districts when we hand down requirements and how we can best work together to make the addition of requirements work for our schools. And with that, to start off the public hearing, I'd like to invite Representative Lim, if you would care to start us off. And
thank you.
Is Representative Wisnant in the room?
No.
Not yet.
If Mr. Olson will read the summary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have three bills before us today. We'll start with House Bill 2510. House Bill 2510 is regarding the high school diploma requirements for science. It requires students who receive a high school diploma to complete 3 credits of science and allows students who do not meet requirements to receive the diploma if the student has met or exceeded academic content standards for science or if the student displays the necessary proficiency in science. It applies to students receiving a high school diploma on or after July 1st, 2011. Committee members, you have before you the preliminary staff measure summary regarding this bill, as well as a handout from the State Board of Education regarding the new diploma requirements announced in January.
Thank you, Mr. Rules.
Are we doing this one bill at a time?
Representative, we are. We have to open a hearing on all three bills to allow people to comment on all three bills.
And do we hear a summary on the other two?
Certainly. That'd be beneficial to you. Go ahead, Mr. Olson, if you would.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry, I was planning to do it when Representative Wisnant testified. I'll go ahead and do those right now. It's important to note that House Bill 2046 is very similar to 2510. Let me read the summary for that. Requires a student who receives a diploma for a school district to complete 3 years of science prior to high school graduation. Allows a student who does not meet the requirement to receive the diploma if the student has met or exceeded academic content standards for science or if the student displays the necessary proficiency in science. Applies the new science requirement to students who receive the high school diploma on or after July 1st, 2011. And again, that is one of the key differences in the two bills. Is one is 2010, is the other is 2011, but they both are regarding the science requirement. The third bill is House Bill 2045, which is regarding civics and economics. It requires students who receive high school diploma to complete 1/2 credit of civics and 1/2 credit of economics. It allows a student who does not meet either requirement to receive the diploma if the student has met or exceeded academic content standards for the subject or displays the necessary proficiency in the subject, and applies to students receiving the high school diploma on or after July 1st, 2011. And, Mr. Chair, if I could just note that there is occasionally in some of these bills referred to as years or credits, they're effectively taken as the same thing, but the legislative council says apparently credits is the preferred term that they're using. Thank you.
And if I may just ask a question. The main difference between the two is one of them has names on it and one doesn't.
House Bill 2046 is from the Interim Committee on Education, and House Bill 2510 is sponsored by Representative Lim. But there's also a difference in the date of application. House Bill 2510 is 1 year earlier than House Bill 2046.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Representative Lim.
Thank you very much, and Chair Buckley and members of the committee. Thank you for hearing this House Bill 2510. And for the record, my name is John Lim, State Representative from District 50, which is Gresham. It is my great honor before you to testify on behalf of this House Bill 2510. Last session, I introduced House Bill 2129, which increased math and English requirement before high school graduation. This was one of the most successful bills last session, and I'm proud that I was one of the chief sponsors of this bill. I'm here before you to continue the good work we did last session and increase graduation requirements for science. House Bill 2510, which increases the graduation requirement for science from 2 years to 3. The requirement applies to students who receive diploma from high school district on or after July 1st, 2010. As the date is concerned, 2010, 2011, 2012, I don't think that's a big issue. And since current English and math requirement begins 2009, and I'm flexible on this 2010 requirement. I believe this is a good bill because our students are competing in global economy, and we need to prepare them for the future. Oregon is among the lowest in the nation with graduation requirement, and we cannot afford to be the bottom dweller any longer. Oregon's future economy is attracting high-tech and healthcare, and these things all require science background. Our booming wine industry is a science by nature. Some concerns have surfaced as I introduced this bill. The first is the one I heard last session with the math and English bill. As the handout you should have received from committee staff shows, state with 3 years of science as of 2006 had a graduation rate from high 50% to low 80% in terms of percentile. This rate was taken from the 2002-2003 school year. This is the most recent information available from both the National Conference of State Legislatures and U.S. Department of Education's National Center for Education Statistics. Oregon's graduation rate was 73% in this time frame. This does not appear to be a strong correlations between high science requirement and graduation rate. This begs the question, what about the dropout rate? The most recent dropout data I received was from the National Center for Education Statistics, was the school year 2001 to 2002. In that year, Oregon dropout rate was 4.9. The range for states with the 3 years of science was anywhere between 3% to 7%. So I do not see a strong correlation between with available data. What about the cost of having 3 years of science? The most recent information for the pupil spending from NCSL and National Education Associations was the school year of 2004-2005. Oregon spent $7,913 a year. The range for pupil spending with the three science state ranges from 6,202 and highest 15,073. The highest is the District of Columbia. Again, this does not seem to be an unbearable burden to incorporate 3 years of science. Last criticism I received is that the State Board of Education has already changed the requirement so that the class of 2012 has 3 years of science. Why do we need this to do this? To that I answer that we need to put 3 years of science into law. Who is to say that the future board do not backslide on this issue? I understand that backslide could be hard to do, but it can happen. We need put this into law. One of the good things about this House Bill 2510 is I put in a proficiency clause so that the local district may award a diploma to students who display an advanced knowledge of science. These students may not require 3 years of science, and also this is a good for the local control issue. My bill does not specify lab courses, but my reading of this bill in this section 1, subsection 1 says you do leave those requirements up to the state board. Thank you very much for your time, and I appreciate your attention on this bill.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions? Seeing none, we'll thank you for your... Do you have anything?
Yeah, yes, I do. Representative Lim, the State Board of Ed has a suggested 3-year science requirement by 2012. Is that basically the same thing as you have?
My bill 2010 says that, but I am willing to go along the suggestions of the 2012.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Jeff. And before I go, just I saw this invest in schools, invest in our future, and may I say that invest in science. And invest in our future.
You know, the security guards grab you if you have science coming in here.
I sneaked out.
Representative Wisnett, would you care to offer an introduction? We've opened a public hearing on all three bills, and if you'd care to offer an introduction to your bill, you'd be welcome to do so at this time.
At this time, on the civics and economics?
Yes. And you can feel free to talk about both bills, all bills.
I think we got
them. All right, very good. I'd like to welcome. It's great to have students here today, and we are debating your future. So every now and then, you can just kind of go like this or like that, you know, as things are.
I just lost my sister's email. Can I get this? Thank you, Mr. Chair, honorable committee members, and staff. Thank you for letting me testify on House Bill 2045. This bill proposes that we add to the high school graduation requirements 1/2 credit of civics and 1/2 credit of economics. I'm not going to talk a lot about civics. I've got someone that's going to, I think, are you signed up to testify? Mrs. Ross is going to testify later. I've been in this body for over 3 years now, and I think that civics is critical to this nation being a role model for democracy in the world. And I participated in several of the classroom law projects, and I also attended the one-day workshop that the Board of Education put on, looking at the high school graduation requirements, and we talked about this. And I appreciate the work of the Board of Education in looking at the high school graduation requirements and all the time and effort they put into that. And a lot of that's by volunteers on that board. And so I don't want to preempt their decision making and their important role in this, but I do think that we need to go back and look at civics and economics. So I think that the Ben Bulletin recently had an article, and I will tell you that it's sort of scary. Even during my campaign, we had a Rotary Club meeting, and it was sort of embarrassing some of the questions that these business leaders of my community didn't know about our government. So I think it's really critical, again, that we educate our children. I know that some of this is being done through reading assignments and things like that, but I think it's critical that we do have a civics, half a unit of civics, where we teach our young people the history of democracies and their role in that democracy. So again, During the article, newspaper article, people couldn't identify their representatives or what they did or how long they served. And I think that's embarrassing as a country as powerful and as we are. So I think this is very critical. Let me, that's as far as the civics. Like I said, I'm going to have expertise also be testifying in front of you. But let me go to the economics, financial management. Probably ask some of the young people in the committee hearing today, how many have cell phones? Okay. And credit cards? You hear that comment? Don't get us too excited. But in today's world, young people do assume financial responsibilities at a very young age. They don't know what it costs or how you pay for that cell phone or how much that credit card is worth. And so I think it's very critical to the education of our young people that we also include a half a credit in economics as a requirement for graduation. I think the committee members have both received copies of two letters. One is from David Cox, president of Economics America. He's at Portland State University endorsing this bill to require one half credit for economics for graduation. Also, you have a letter from, what do you have? You have the letter from David Cox, and you have from our former economist, Tom Portoski, encouraging from peace. With Portland State University and endorsing this requirement for economics and the graduation requirement. You also all received a copy of a letter from Ted Schreinman, instructor in economics and director for Center of Economics Education, supporting this bill. So I think there's academia people out there that also feel that this is very important to our young people to offer that. I apologize to the committee. I was trying to arrange to have a credit union member testify in front of you today, because if you don't know, the credit union has a very active, successful program to go into our schools to teach the children, our young people, about financial management and financial responsibility. And it's similar to the Classroom Law Project in that they have curriculum, and they will go in and help the teacher. They'll provide books, curriculum, instruction, teacher aids to do this program. So the financial impact should be pretty small. We don't have a financial impact statement on this bill for these two units right now, but because Classroom Law Project will tell you that they'll provide textbook and help the teachers learn how to present the curriculum, and the credit unions do the same thing for the financial management. They provide books. It comes from the National Endowment for Financial Education that provides the textbooks and the training and the curriculum. So, Mr. Chair and committee members, unless you have any questions, I'll be brief and end that. I strongly support the addition to our high school graduation requirements of a half a unit of civics and a half a unit of economics, financial management.
Thank you. Representative, since we have you at our beck and call, more or less, in the committee, I'll invite you to come back and invite Representative Flores to come up, because I believe she also wants to offer some testimony on this
expert
bill.
Expert testimony.
And members, we do have members from the state board here, as well as, I think, some school district representatives to testify on these bills as well. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Linda Flores. I'm state representative for House District 51. And I am here today to testify in support of the civics element of this committee bill. And I'm going to give you some quotes from various meetings that I've had the privilege to attend, the third and fourth congressional conference on civics education, I believe, and I looked over my shoulder at Barbara Rost, who is the leading guru at Classroom Law Project and with whom I had become acquainted a couple of years ago, and kind of has spurred my zeal for the civics element in our education system. What you're receiving is a document entitled Advancing the Civic Mission of Schools, and it's just kind of a reference tool for you as we consider this bill and the inclusion or the refocusing of civics learning in the state of Oregon. In the 1800s, the very premise of public education was established on the premise that individuals do not automatically become free, responsible, and engaged citizens. While many institutions, including families, religious congregations, community-based organizations, and voluntary associations help form civic character, public education is the one unifying institution where people can acquire knowledge and develop dispositions for an informed, reasonable participation. And that is the civic mission of schools. Before we can really improve civic education or civic learning, we need to remedy some of the specific shortcomings, such as inadequate policy support, inadequate curricular requirements, and inadequate teacher preparation. But we must also address the problem caused by assessment in a few subjects, diverting attention from other worthy subjects, including civics. Now, what we often hear is what gets tested gets taught. So, if that's true, what gets taught is what's learned. This is probably the sum and substance of my encouragement to you today as you consider this bill and the refocusing of our state emphasis on civics learning in Oregon. It is true, we have a civics requirement in the social studies element, but as we have worked in our state and across the nation to develop our students to be prepared to enter workforce in higher education, it has come at the cost of some of the fundamental premises for the establishment of our public education system, and that is to create an informed, engaged citizenry. Thomas Jefferson said that preparing a democracy is never a one-time learning, it's an ongoing achievement. And Horace Mann, the father of public education, said, "Let us not be content to wait and see what will happen, but give us the determination to make the right things happen." So as we enter this dialogue, I will leave you with that, and thank you very much for your consideration today.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions?
Representative Dahlem.
Yes, Representative Flores. Presently, we require 3 credits of social studies, what the State Board of Ed does and ultimately the Department of Ed. Is it my understanding that you would have one of these 3 credits be civics, or would this be a requirement on top of those 3?
Well, it would be my anticipation that it would be one of those elements would be civics education. If I might supplement, Mr. Chair, with your permission.
Please.
Also, once again, I don't know if she has her curriculum with her, so I do not want to steal her thunder, but Classroom Law Project has been very engaged in promoting, and perhaps some of you have even been involved in some of the We the People competitions, the Citizen in the Constitution that is for high school students, We the People that is for middle school, and We the People, the Citizen in the Constitution, which is for 5th grade, I believe. And the anecdote that Justice Susan Leeson shared when we were back at the 4th Congressional Conference on Civics Education. Yes, Representative Dahlem and Wisnett, I was there, you were not. Was that a school that she's aware of and a classroom that she was aware of did not have resources to buy various curriculum, but they had invested in the We the People curriculum, and they were able to use it not only to teach reading, but to engage in math and to engage in geography, as well as other elements of those things that students are required to learn. So there is much that can be done with limited resource and a fine curriculum. So I would just offer that to you also as encouragement.
Any other questions? Representative Kopp.
Representative Flores, thank you. Thank you, Chair Buckley. Do you know, or is anybody that's presenting today, when did the requirements change that econ and civics wasn't, part of the required?
Mr. Chair, Representative Comp, I don't know that there's been a change. I think it's just been a dilution of focus. There is still a requirement in the statute for a certain amount of social studies. And
right.
I think that the focus has been on aligning our students learning to meet state report card and annual yearly progress under No Child Left Behind in the three right. elements.
Right. Well, and Chair Buckley, because maybe the question might be, was certain curriculum part of local control? Because I know many high schools used to have personal finance, economics right. as a requirement, and now you don't see it in that course curriculum requirements. And like I say, maybe that was local control versus what's in the statute.
Okay. And that is an ongoing discussion.
Any further questions?
Representative Rilder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry I didn't get here. But I believe it was the social studies is a requirement in the statute. Economics and all how they all done is in administrative rule. And it's still there. But they've melded it, basically, and said you can do part of it this year and part of it this year as opposed to a particular course.
And, Mr. Chair, I suspect that the department may be testifying, and I do have their document that was distributed. Well, I guess I didn't bring it down with me during the interim on the requirements that Oregon does have in place.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Could we have, let's have Barbara Rost and maybe Amy Emerheim come up together, if that's all right. And Barbara, since we've been speaking about this subject, if you would start off and give us a little more background on your area of expertise, and I will model from Representative Clem and introduce my school board member, Amy Emerheim, from the Ashland School District is here, and I've known Amy for many years, and it's great to have you here for this hearing today.
Thank you. It's great to see you sitting there. I love that gavel thing.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Representative Buckley, for having me here today, and thank you, members of the committee, for this opportunity to speak to you about civics education. My name is Barbara Rost. I am the program director at Classroom Law Project. And Classroom Law Project, if you don't know, the organization is just a small nonprofit organization whose mission is to help children become active citizens by bringing together the legal community and educators and civic leaders to make civic education come alive in the classroom. That's it in a nutshell. I hope that I'm able to offer you today some information that will be helpful. So Classroom Law Project did a civic survey last spring, and it might be helpful to know a little bit more about that, as well as some observations that Classroom Law Project has made over the course of time. Today, we're talking about civics and about science, and I'm reminded of what Justice Sandra Day O'Connor said last spring. In an article published by the Washington Post, she and Roy Romer said that we need more students proficient in math and science and engineering. We need them also to be prepared for their role as citizens. Only then can self-government work. Only then will we not only be more competitive, but also remain the beacon of liberty in a tumultuous world. Preserving our democracy should be reason enough to promote civic learning. Justice O'Connor and Mr. Romer are part of that national movement to restore the civic mission of school that Representative Flores talked about just a little while ago, and there are other legislators and civic leaders throughout the state that are involved in this. And in that movement and in that field generally, nationwide, we see that the studies show that there is a precipitous decline in civic education, that students score below proficient on standards. And we see that that's true in Oregon as well. We know this because of the survey conducted last spring, and a summary of that is in your materials, both a one-pager and a slick multi-page version, but it's also short. My focus is primarily on the portion of the survey where we surveyed about 800 students from 10 high schools all over the state, suburban, urban, rural, quite a wide demographic. And these students were enrolled in a civic or government education course at the time of the survey. I think that's critical to note. When we look at the results, we see what amounts to a good news, bad news story. The good news is that these students strongly endorse the qualities of a socially and responsible citizenry. They are very active in volunteering. Over 90% of them have positive feelings about this or have actually volunteered. That's the good news. The bad news is that they lack basic civic knowledge. For example, only 25% of them, well, two-thirds of them, scored basic knowledge questions correctly. 25% of them could identify Oregon's two U.S. senators. Only 25%. 23% of them thought that Ted Kulongoski was one of them. Other point. Not yet. That's still another one. The survey results showed, and there's more detail in your packet, so I won't take your time up with all the minutia of the percentages, but generally speaking, it shows that political trust is low. They don't trust you as a body. They don't trust government generally. They don't see what government's doing for them. Participation in political activities is correspondingly low. And taken together, all of these results show that what Oregon students need is help in connecting the dots, because if they will volunteer, they can certainly learn what government is doing for them and how they can take an active role in it. One survey participant said that students here in Oregon will readily volunteer to clean up a beach, but will not support the candidate who will require that beach to be kept clean. So I think that kind of is the nutshell of the state of things in Oregon. As Representative Flores alluded to, the demands on schools to meet the requirements of state standards, of school report cards, of the federal No Child Left Behind Act are enormous. And sadly, these demands mean that civic education has been left behind. So I'm really pleased to be here to have the forum to talk about civic education in general and House Bill 2045 in particular, because it invites the discussion about civics, how it can be a quality program, and what it takes to get that into more classrooms. And at Classroom Law Project, we believe that the key is in quality professional development. House Bill 45, as you know, calls for every high school graduate to have a half credit civics and a half credit of economics. And as you know, 22 credits are required now. That's soon to change to 24. How that will play out with respect to these half credits, it's my understanding, like Representative Flores, that the half credit for each of those is part and parcel of the three that's now assigned to social studies. It's important to know that within that, and the work of the Department of Education here in Oregon has been very diligent. We have pretty strong state standards in the area of social studies and of social science analysis, and the state Department of Education has also put together an assessment tool for social studies. It's an optional assessment tool because, again, what Representative Flores discussed is what's going on in the nation and here in the state is if it ain't tested, it ain't taught, is generally the feeling. And so, of course, there is some wonderful civics education going on in some schools, but as we know, in many schools, there is considerably less than that. So changing the law to require a half credit in civics and economics, along with the English and math, as House Bill 2045 does, is laudable so long as teachers are equipped to handle the task. Districts have poured precious resources into professional development for raising math and English scores. Are they also willing or able to provide professional development support for civics? We think this is a very important question. We think this because of what we hear going on out there in classrooms. For example, a professor of social studies methods in rural Oregon told us a week or so ago that he's very concerned about the quality of education in the social studies area and civics that's going on because teachers teaching that are not credentialed in that area. This notion is echoed when we talk to folks in middle school who say that they have an opening in their school for a language arts social studies block teacher. Well, we're told that social studies teachers need not apply, that with the high stakes testing for English, they will hire the language arts teacher, they will not hire the social studies teacher. So civics, again, is being left behind. Teaching civics needs to go beyond the reciting of the three branches of government. Students must wrestle with larger public issues underlying the principles of democracy and ways that they can participate in local government and civil society. The price we pay for not doing that is very high. In your packets, you have a report that looks like this, and it's kind of the seminal piece. It's the report on the civic mission of schools. And in this report, and I'll quote, it says that teaching civics the stereotypical way with rote facts and about dry procedures is unlikely to benefit students and may actually alienate them from public participation, including voting. So teaching it the wrong way can make them still more cynical. We don't want that to happen. The same report, however, offers six promising approaches to teaching civic education, and they include the things that you already know works really well in classrooms, the simulations, the role plays, the discussion of current issues, as well as teaching about fundamentals of government and history, law, and democracy. So I really do urge that you take a look at this as time allows. I learn things from it every time I read it. There's still more. It's jam-packed. So as this committee thinks about what to do about civic education and requiring more credits, we encourage you to consider how to get more quality professional development into the mix. Some options to consider include adding supporting language for professional development to House Bill 2045, to including professional development provision in still another bill, to supporting the policy package in the governor's budget, which includes $175,000 for civic education to the Department of Education, and also to look in your packet at the legislation that was enacted in Colorado that supports professional development for civic education. It's one model to look at, not a cookie cutter, but what could Oregon do that might be similar. You know, at the close of the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia in 1787, it said that Benjamin Franklin was asked, what have we got, sir? Is it a republic or a monarchy? And he responded, a republic, if you can keep it. To keep it, we must teach civics. We must provide every generation anew with the knowledge, skills, and dispositions to be active citizens. We can do that by including professional development in bills such as House Bill 2045. And I would hate to think that we have to choose science over civics, but in grappling with that very difficult issue, which I know you will do because it's about allocating scarce resources, I looked to my husband for the answer. You see, he's a middle school science teacher. He's also a Vietnam War veteran. So I asked him, if it was tomorrow's headline and you were reading the article about this hearing, what would you say? And he said, well, teach more civics. Teach more civics. Our youth need to learn how to be active citizens and how to be discerning voters. As between that and more science from the science teacher, he said, more civics. So with that, I'll take any questions that you may have. And I don't know if I can answer them or not, but I'd be happy to give it a try.
Just don't say your husband's name. Okay, just leave it.
Members, any questions?
I disagree.
Representative Greenick.
Thank you. Actually, I think learning about the three branches of government wouldn't hurt her. Some people in this building strikes me have problems with the separation of powers. But
thank you, Representative.
I'm intrigued with how we deal with this question of the disposition to be an active citizen rather than the knowledge. I'm your findings that here are people who want to be citizens but they don't trust government as if somehow government is some alien that's dropped in here from Mars onto our planet. And I mean, the concept that you really do lose out of the revolution is that the government is us. I mean, we are the people. And I know there's always a problem with trying to teach values as a part of education, although it's hard not to do that. But I'd be curious if you talk a little bit about how we instill this sense of social responsibility for, and if not for government, at least for our civic society, the fact that we own our civic society, and that has some responsibilities that goes with it, taxes, voting, participating, a whole bunch of things. How do you get that into the curriculum? How are we going to train people to be a part of civic life in a way that makes a difference?
Chairman Buckley and Representative Greenluck, I think that's an excellent question, and I think that goes to the heart of good quality professional development. What I see that as going beyond the separation of powers, which, yes, we certainly need to have a little primer on from time to time, but the kinds of things that help children grapple with those fundamental issues are the ones, in my view, that get them hands-on involved. For example, this year's high school mock trial that, there are about 80 high school teams from across the state of Oregon that are participating in that. The subject matter of that particular trial deals with hate crimes, skinheads, murders of an Ethiopian, and so on. Those difficult issues packaged in a mock trial give students the forum to safely discuss and unpack those troubling kinds of current issues that should be grappled with. And doing it in the form of a mock trial, a simulation, the kind of promising approaches discussed in this, gives them a way to become involved and yet stay detached. Other hands-on kinds of things that can help with those, build the dispositions to be an active citizen. There's a curriculum called Project Citizen that gets young people involved in looking at a local public policy issue and then trying to figure out what to do about it. And so it becomes their class project. And so while many schools have great food drives or clothing drives or something of that nature, again, what civics needs to do is connect those dots. So it's wonderful that my kid is raiding my pantry and taking all the green beans, but what I'd really like her to do is grapple with, well, now, what is it that's causing this hunger? And, gee, maybe there's a bill that's being looked at that can help solve the problem of hunger in our state. And so we need teachers to connect those dots for the students that will then enhance the disposition to become more involved in that as they grow older. Two small examples of the kinds of things that teachers can do in their classrooms. Another important element, and I'll just stop with that one, but it's about learning how to be good discussants, how to discuss. We often talk to teachers about whatever issue of the day is, and they'll say, yes, 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 we do debates in our classroom. Well, you know, debates mean there's a winner and there's a loser. How about becoming a discussant so we can learn about consensus and compromise and discussing and sharing and not being adversarial? Those are the dispositions that are part and parcel of the kinds of things that we'd like to see in more classrooms and good professional development could provide.
Ms. Rubin.
I'll follow up a little bit with that one as well, because I think that one of the concerns that I have is that we do have assessment tools that assess basic knowledge. But we don't have assessment tools that assess that engagement part. And so I guess my two-part question is that how do we get the combination of universities are pushing a narrow form of education sometimes with regard to civics and so on. And that is not exactly the route that we want to take to get that engagement. It's more of the academic portion of it as opposed to the heart part of it, understanding really what civics is about. How do we engage that so that our high school teachers oftentimes feel conflicted that they have to teach this subject because that's what they need to get in to get to their university, whereas they know what they need is this engagement part, you know, the simulations and stuff, but that takes more time. How do we have that kind of discussion so that we can have both those things happen, so that they can feel comfortable they're going to be prepared for college and be comfortable that they're getting excited about what their civic obligation is?
Chairman Buckley, Representative Roblin, that's hard. But I think it can be done. It can be rolled into some projects. For example, the essential skills package that the State Board of Education has put forward, many of them, when I look at the checkoff lists, are accomplished with the Project Citizen curriculum. So if they use Project Citizen to do those things, they'd be learning some civics as well as all of those other things, including math, including technology, and so on. So we can use civic projects, civic education, civic learning, civic engagement, to get to many of these other tools. That's part of it. I think, and I don't mean to hide the ball here and dodge, but assessments and how to get that is not my strongest area, and I would defer to the experts in both higher education and in the department, the Oregon Department of Education, for a precise answer on that. I do know that they have an instrument, the Oregon Department of Education, that's really quite good on social studies and includes social science analysis, which goes to some of those more not bubble filling in answers. And there are many assessments that teachers can do in their own classrooms short of the bubble answer that is more typically found in math or science or something. So there are ways to get there, and there are many people working on it. The state of Washington last session passed an assessment bill for social studies in their classes for civics, and it needed to be an in-class assessment by teachers. And actually, the state of Oregon is working with Washington in putting together some assessments that are good on that. So I know that there are some people that are working on that very diligently, but those individuals do not include myself, and so I defer to the true experts on that.
Representative Dahlin.
Yes, thank you for coming today. I'm not sure I shouldn't start with declaring a conflict of interest. I taught social studies for 10 years. I believe we ought to require 3 years of civics, no years of science. But I do want to say I am puzzled because Teacher Standards and Practices has told this committee, or at least in the last session and in the interim committee, that we turn out one of the best cadres of teachers in the nation. If I'm to accept that at full faith and credit, then I must say that in the classroom, those people, if civics is taught, and if they are truly highly qualified teachers, they will come up with the ways and the ideas to impart civics. Then the issue is, at what point do I enter the game and say this is what they must do? And I just told you I want 3 years of civics and 5 years of econ and 2 full semesters of pre-Civil War American history. But at what point do I say some of these things belong at the local level? Now, if they've abandoned them, and I think we agree, particularly with the science and the civics, that they're valuable, then we have to have some authority to dig that nugget out and say you won't abandon civics. Because I'm in the legislature and I got to vote and I have a good friend that proposed legislation, but I want to go through the process. I want to be sure that everyone gets involved, that everyone has a say. Have you been to the State Board of Ed with your presentation on the Classroom Law Project?
Not to the board as a whole, but to individual members.
And I don't know if this is a question. I suggest you go because you are so compelling. And the information you bring is so compelling. I would like to say to the State Board of Ed, you have about until the end of June to get some civics into the curriculum, or we'll get in there and muck around for you. But I won't say that until they come to the dais. Thank you for that question.
Thank you for your testimony.
Can I ask a question?
Representative Greenlee.
Yeah, I've in this document,
yes,
it says only 1.6% of students can identify James Madison as the father of our Constitution. What made James Madison the father of our Constitution, as opposed to Jefferson and Adams and Franklin and
Representative Buckley, Representative Greenlee, I did not write the survey instrument.
Representative Greenlee.
I'm not going to take that.
At the convention, Jefferson was a reluctant warrior and only wrote the document. Madison.
Not but Franklin and Adams.
They're the sons and brothers and cousins.
We're having a discussion. You can always identify the mother or something? Was that?
We'll set up a separate forum,
the
I think, for
a bit of a problem.
Mr. Chair.
One question.
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Here was one question. So, in your opinion, when we teach as a requirement of civic, do you believe that the ratings of politicians will go up?
Do I agree that the ratings of
political elections will go up?
Yes. No, I'm talking about the politicians.
We'll look at this out at all.
Mr. Chair, if I might add just one thing.
Certainly.
In response to Representative Dallum's comments about the local control and at what level does the legislature come in, I think that's really an important question.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the reasons why Classroom Law Project is so firmly in the camp of professional development. If we look at programs of the nature of the type done in Colorado, those are regional workshops. And so it's very local. And where mock trial might be a great program in one school, it might not in another. And where some schools might want to take on learning how to really do good discussion techniques in their classes, another school might not. And so good professional development that helps schools go where they want to go with this, but knowing they need to go somewhere, is why we're so firmly in that camp.
What does that come?
I just have to comment, and it's my bias, but there is excellent curriculum out there like We the People, and there's another curriculum that is highly developed, it's called History Alive. Any professional that takes the training in it loves it, but it is so time intensive, and it is absolutely hands-on, incredible curriculum that has every facet of social science embedded in it, so the civics would not be lost. But we are so bound to the textbook and the test that good professional development, good curriculum is just ignored, and it's sad. So that's my two cents on it.
Thank you, Representative. Well, let's get some conversation on local control from a local school board member.
Thank you, Chairman Buckley. I had some written comments, and after listening to this conversation, I'm not sure that it certainly is still relevant, but I would like to address some of the other issues that you have been discussing today.
Would you identify yourself for the record?
Absolutely. I'm Amy Amrine. I live in Ashland, Oregon, and I am on the school board in Ashland. I've been a school board member for 6 years.
Thank you.
And I wish my superintendent could be here with me today because she is much more articulate and knowledgeable about the details of all of this. But I was sent instead, so here I am. I think in the big part of the discussion for the local implementation of mandates, and we certainly have had a number of mandates here in the last several years, including the No Child Left Behind Act and the new requirements coming down from the Department of Ed for high school graduation, what it comes down to is that we all agree that we want rigorous programs and well-educated children, and we are doing our best to fulfill the mandates and meet the requirements that are required of us, and we completely agree with the goal of rigor and high standards. Having said that, what it comes down to on the local level is really time and money, and the ability to implement. And what I, when I'm hearing all of the new requirements, 3 years of science, perhaps civics, perhaps econ, my concern for our children and for our high school, 4 years of our high school time that we have with the children, is really the time that they have to get all of these classes in. We have a broad range of electives for children that it's important that they have time in their day to take. And that's not to say that science and math and reading and civics and econ are not equally or perhaps a little bit more important, but Representative Lynn made note or addressed the idea of a higher dropout rate if you have only prescribed classes. Our concern is that if there are too many mandated classes, the children do not have time in their day to take the classes that keep them perhaps engaged and give them a broader experience to see what else is out there for their lives and what they might be interested in doing. In the past several years, we have gone in our high school from an 8-period day to a 7-period day, and that has been completely driven by the funding issue. Other districts in the Rogue Valley have gone to a 6-period day. The time to get everything in for college requirements and mandates is shrinking. We heard on the steps today, one of the shortest school years in the country. Time is very important in a school day. We have been talking about, and it's not on your docket today to be discussed, but also the requirement for 3 years of high school math, and that needs to start with algebra. We can certainly embed algebra one and geometry in other classes and teach math through other classes. But when you get to algebra two, that's a theoretical class, and you must teach Algebra 2 as a class. And what of children who struggle with math? How are they going to be able to get a high school diploma if they can't get through Algebra 2? We had a conversation with our principals the other day. The board and our superintendent principals had a conversation about if you're going to need Algebra 2, and perhaps you have to move that all the way to your senior year, you have to look at your entire curriculum and actually maybe perhaps move algebra into middle school for everyone. Do they take 2 years in middle school so that they can get to algebra in high school and leave some time for failure? So that's math. Science is somewhat similar with two lab classes. It's finding the space, making sure you have enough classes for two labs. I completely agree we need to do it. I absolutely want to do it. I think 3 years of math, 3 years of science, 4 years of English. I'd love to do civics. I think econ is extremely important. Our question is, how do we do it? How do we pay for it? How do we hire the teachers? How do we do the professional development? How do we find the time in our day for professional development? And then how do we implement? And we all agree it needs to be done, and it's when you mandate it, it really shoves the other things that are not mandated and that are elective out of the day. And that's very hard to watch because some children need those. Many children need those electives and some study halls.
My son needs a study hall.
I have two high school boys, and when we actually in Ashland have a youth activities levy which pays for our after school activities, and so we have a very broad breadth, and we are very fortunate that our local community has supported this through the years. But we have a lot of kids, 85% of our children do after school extracurricular and co-curricular activities, and that is of high value, and they are learning a great deal through those activities. But some of those would have to go with too many mandates.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dom was first. Representative Greenham, I'm going to go first.
Thank you, Chairman Buckley. As the board chair?
No, I was board chair for 2 years. Now I am simply a member on the end of the dais.
comfortable spot.
I like that.
As a board member, would it be more appropriate for us to say to you, we want our students to achieve this level of understanding in math? Or is it more appropriate for us to say to you as a board member, give us 3 years of math?
I think that's an excellent question. I think math is a more difficult question. I was thinking actually as we were talking about civics that a credit for proficiency would perhaps be more beneficial because many children are taught at home and have a broader range of civic understanding. So perhaps for that type of a class it would be appropriate. Math, I'm not sure, just speaking personally, whether you can get algebra or geometry or advanced algebra 2 without some seat time. I think for certain classes you probably need seat time, and math is probably one of those.
I guess where I was going, if you were to embed algebra in the 8th grade, which is not uncommon,
mm-hmm.
or if you were to embed some geometry in the 5th grade, mm-hmm. which is not uncommon,
mm-hmm.
then you wouldn't be dealing with seat time for everybody, you'd be dealing with seat time for those that needed proficiency.
It would help.
So where I was going was, is the mandate for proficiency better than the mandate for seat time? And if you were able to remove Ashland from the world and design your own system, would you use proficiency or would you use Carnegie seat time units?
I think we would use proficiency.
Thank you very much.
Representative Greenlink. My memory was tweaked by what you just said. I took economics 50 some years ago from the golf coach. But, one thing that I still remember from that time was Gresham's Law, which is in monetary terms that bad currency drives good currency out of circulation. And it seems to me you just expressed an example of Gresham's Law, and it's really worth exploring. The question is, what do we lose as we put these specific requirements? One more year of science, one more year of math, one more year of English. Maybe all of them good things, but what does that push out? And I get email all the time from people who want to have music and art mm-hmm. education, which they think is very important. People who want to have physical education, which we think in terms of the health of the child is very important. And there are some other very important things that can happen in school. So it would seem to me it would be useful for you as a school board member to help us on what gets pushed out of the curriculum as we keep adding more requirements to the curriculum.
I can tell you that we are looking at eliminating carpentry and welding and foods next year, mostly because of what we have to get into the day and because of funding issues. We happen to be in a declining enrollment situation, so we are looking, in spite of the wonderful numbers that we're talking about at the state level, we are still looking at losing 100 children, which will be approximately $500,000 cut in our district. So we are looking at having to keep what is mandated and what we have to do, and then also that goes to class size. So we have to be looking at if we have to be teaching other classes at the high school level, that does get pushed down and hire certain teachers to hire certain classes because we need to be highly qualified, then that will take money away from the classes at the lower level, which means higher class sizes.
Could I follow up on that, please?
Representative?
Are those classes, those technical education classes, mm-hmm. a part of vocational training for some of your graduates, or are they all going off to college?
They are elective. Some of them go to community college. Some of them do go out and get jobs in the workforce, but they are vocational education classes. We do not have a vocational education strand, so we're not eliminating, we're eliminating classes, not programs.
We already eliminated the program.
I know. By eliminating the class, you eliminate the program.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Dullum.
Yes, well, Representative Greenlink raises an interesting question. If we were to say to you that we want our students to be able to identify the senator from their state or mm-hmm. Pick some bubble answer that we can make, and if you could have that option? Would it give the local boards more freedom in how they might allocate the money to meet the myriad of mandates that they have?
If you were to give us, and that gets back into proficiency versus seat time, if you were to say you wanted certain things taught, state senators, you know, we have to know all the state senators, you have to know all that type, again, we could embed it, and I understand that some school districts have been losing that part of what we want to have embedded because of other pressures. But yes, it would give us more flexibility as opposed to saying a half a credit of civics. And that would certainly be helpful. And I completely can support having more professional development time to make sure that our teachers are qualified to embed the information. I would ask you specifically, though, to not prescribe curriculum, because what is acceptable in Eagle Point, Oregon, may not be acceptable in Ashland, Oregon, which may not be acceptable in Pendleton, Oregon. So I would ask you, I think, was it last semester you had a discussion about Eddie the Eagle and whether that curriculum was appropriate. And so I would ask you not to specifically go to a curriculum, but you know, if you're going to prescribe civics, just then give it to the local control folks and say, teach civics, but not a particular program.
Well, thank you. Thank you for your service as a board member.
You're welcome.
Thank you for today.
Thank you. I appreciate your time.
And thank you so much. Drive safe back.
Thank you.
And
see you in Ashland.
I echo what my colleague here said. Thank you for being on the board. Thank you for taking
care
of our kids.
Thank you.
It's an easy job.
Especially with the pay so high.
Yeah. We actually have our two representatives from the State Board of Education, Jerry Berger and Duncan Wise, are here. They'd like to... After listening for an hour, gentlemen, of the various aspects of this issue, be delighted to hear how it looks from your point of view.
Chair Buckley and members of the committee, I'm Jerry Berger. I'm presently the chair of the State Board of Education. To my right is Duncan Wise, who is the vice chair of the State Board of Education. Fascinating the first hour. Duncan and I have had the opportunity to hear those discussions for the last 2.5 years, and we have heard these discussions from a variety of people. The great news is there are many, many people, many parents, many educators that have the same goal, which is to provide educational opportunities so students can be successful in their next steps after high school. So for the past over 2 years, your State Board of Education has been struggling with what should be in the Oregon graduation requirements. There has not been a major restructuring of the Oregon education requirements since the early 90s when we had the 21st Century Act. And you have words such as SIM, you have CAM, you have, and everybody has opinions on that. Over 2 years ago, we went out with a white paper and asked people, what do you think ought to be in the high school graduation requirements? We got hundreds of responses. We took those responses, we analyzed them, and then we sent out a draft. Of this is what we thought we heard. This is our best thinking of what ought to be, we think might be, in the graduation requirements. Members of the committee attended this past summer the State Board of Education retreat, where we had over 150 people, representing stakeholders, educators, community people, legislators, workforce folks, etc., that took another look at what we had. Then for the past 6 months, we took that out again. We took that information, put it together, and had more input for the last 6 months. In January, we adopted what we think is makes sense for the state of Oregon for graduation requirements. Just so you are aware, Your State Board of Education is made up of 7 members, 5 from each one from each congressional district, and 2 at large. So it is a group that is statewide. The longest serving member is finishing up his 8th year, so that will be a new appointment coming up. And the other 5, there's 1 appointment now not filled. I think we are relatively young, meaning time spent in the state board. I think the latest, I got on about 2.5 years ago, and then Duncan about 2 years ago. But we took it as our charge to take a look at that. During all that time, we've attempted to keep interim committees, legislators involved. You have a lot of material. You got a note from me about new graduation requirements. State Superintendent of Public Instruction just sent out, I think, last week, a packet which had a video and the requirements that we've adopted. And that's kind of the process we went through. One of the handouts I did, staff prepared for us, was a map showing hearings we had around the state regarding the graduation requirements. So I want to assure you that the work by the State Board of Education has not been 7 people running around hiding in a corner saying this is what we think is good. We do know that scientists love science. We do know that social science people love social science. We do know that physical education instructors love physical education. We do know. What your board has tried to do is put together a template of offerings that make a difference and will make a difference and improve student achievement. I'm going to turn it over to Duncan, but I would say one of the, a really good discussion, the first part. We are meshing together credit requirements, that's a Carnegie unit, seat time, et cetera, with proficiencies and essential skills. That's one thing in these plans, in this that we've adopted, that we are very excited about, that if a student can learn Algebra 1 in the 6th grade, they're done with Algebra 1. Then they can go more if they can learn civics. So we are meshing together, and we're working very strongly. We mesh credit and proficiency. Also, as a check and balance on the credit requirements, we are asking for essential skills, that if you don't have these essential skills, it doesn't matter how many credits you have, you don't graduate from high school, because we want a check and balance on seat time versus what do you know. With that, I'll turn it over to Duncan.
But before you do that, Representative Duff, go ahead.
Actually, I'm most interested in knowing how that, you use the example Algebra 1, and many schools are offering Algebra pre-high school and find themselves in the dilemma that they can't meet the graduation requirements because they can't experiment with what is a proven method. How then do they get credits onto this sheet when the math was taken in the 6th grade? What's the mechanics for that?
So the mechanics, and keep in mind that I'm the chair and some of the details I don't know, but schools have the option to give credit to students when they earn that credit. So Algebra 1 is one of those classes that many middle school students take. The State Department of Education would recognize, as long as that Algebra 1 meets the standards which we have, and say they do it in the 8th grade, which is in many cases when a lot of students that are making progress in math take Algebra 1, that will count for a math requirement in high school, even though they're not yet in high school.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Can I do a follow-up?
It's going to come.
And that's back to something that Representative Dahlem and I talk about on a regular basis, and that is local control. The local districts have that opportunity. And I can't tell you how it angers some educators when that opportunity is taken away from our children and they're not given that credit. So I'm not into mandates, but...
You're into opportunity.
Yeah, lots of opportunity. Don't take it away and close doors on our children.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Duncan Wise. I'm the Vice Chair of the State Board of Education, and we are really happy to have the opportunity to testify on the three bills, 2046, 2045, and 2510. The Board has not officially taken position on any of the bills. We've had conversations among ourselves that actually have not formally taken a position, but I think, at least reflecting on our perspective as two Board members, we'd actually encourage you not to adopt these resolutions today, and we'll suggest an amendment. And the reason isn't because we don't agree with the goals. We absolutely do. In fact, we've placed them in the requirements, and we'll talk to the specific goals in just a moment. But this is really about a civics question: who's responsible for designing the high school diploma in Oregon? And when we took responsibility as members of the Board, we had our governor come before us and told us we need to step up, exactly what Representative Lim suggested. He said the high school diploma requirements in Oregon are not acceptable, and we've got to change them. Your assignment is to go out and do this work. We also have very much heard from the legislators, including Representative Lim last session, a lot of you, that we need to take a fundamental look at the high school diploma requirements, including the certificates of initial and advanced mastery and the current requirements, and come up with a new model, a new design for high school that set the goal of high achievement for all within the parameters that give the schools the flexibility they need to encourage all students to meet high standards. And that's what we're about. I can't tell you we're done. This is really hard work. Really hard work, and as Chair Berger just mentioned, we have been lobbied heavily by a lot of different groups. Some of you are on the Workforce Committee. Last week we heard why every student absolutely must have a professional technical course in high school, and we have heard why everyone needs a language course and the arts course, and on and on and on. What we're trying to do is create a diploma that allows each student to define a personal plan and profile that leads them to their career goals, their life goals, and allows them to navigate through high school with as much flexibility as possible to meet those goals, understanding that there are some bedrock principles that we want all students bedrock knowledge and skills that we want all students to obtain. And it is, I would tell you, an incredibly delicate balance in coming up with that design, and that's what we've tried to do in the policy that you have before you. We can walk through, and I'd be happy to walk through the details of that if you'd like me to, but I guess what I would entreat you to do is to say, let us do this work, and let us engage with you about the work. And if you have an interest in something like science education or civics and economics education, I would encourage you to draft a bill to ask us, what are the current requirements? What are the current practices out in the field? What is the state of student knowledge and skills in each of these areas? What could we do to better as a system to improve in these areas? And direct that work to us. We want to know what's on your mind. Let me speak to the two areas that are in front of you today, starting with civics and economics. I am as passionate as anyone in this room about the importance of civics and economics education. Actually, the survey that Barbara mentioned, we were participating in with the Oregon Community Foundation, but my other job, my regular job, the Business Council, we did work on that survey. I'm very passionate about this issue, and I understand that we currently have three social studies requirements. I understand that we have civics, economics, history, geography standards in place today. If students met those standards, we'd be golden. They would know who the senators are. They would know who you are, and they know a lot more. But it's not happening right now. So we've got to figure out what the challenges are. And I believe, as the Classroom Raw Project agrees, that it's about the type of curriculum. It's about creating curriculum that really motivates students to learn. So we've got to figure out how to do that. And if that's a passion of yours, as it is for me, please direct us to study this, come back with recommendations. My guess is it's not going to be around requiring a half credit of economics and civics. I don't think that's the problem here. I think it's much deeper, and you've heard a lot about it already today. And so I encourage you, again, to direct that energy to, and we'll come back through the department with a report on how to address that. Similarly on science, we're struggling with science. We've adopted the requirement of three science credits with two lab sciences as part of it. We are hearing pushback from some of the districts about the resource requirements. We promised to them that we will review the resource issue with them. We've got an implementation team that's taken a really hard look at what the current practices are, what would it take in terms of teachers, lab space, and so on. And we're trying to do this in a way that gives the districts the flexibility to teach science in a variety of settings, while still meeting high standards. And so we'll continue to work that, and I can assure you that it's a goal of ours. But again, rather than putting it in statute, and again, as much as we conceptually would agree with the direction, what we believe is that we need flexibility to manage the entire diploma process so that it balances those many, many interests rather than trying to take one subject at a time. It's very easy to say any one subject is really, really important, but unless it's in the context of the whole, I think we could easily pile on too much and make it an unworkable plan for the local districts to implement. So, in summary, we'd like to be your partner with this. We've talked with you before on this. We want to stay engaged in suggesting this course. We are in no way suggesting that you don't stay engaged. We want to be very much hearing what you're hearing, what's on your mind. But we do think, given the focus we're placing on this as a board and trying to see the whole here and really make sure it meshes with the overall curriculum and frankly, meshes with the middle school and the steps beyond high school, whether it's higher ed, workforce, community college, or other directions, we think there's a value of having a group of us looking at the whole and making policy decisions in context of the whole set of requirements. Thank you.
Questions?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lynn.
Good to see you.
Great to see you.
And this is science requirement, 3 years.
Yes.
It's already doing it.
Yes.
And then what's the point? Don't do it and hold on to it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lim, it's philosophical, honestly. I mean, you can argue any of these. Yes, we're doing it, so why would we oppose? Again, what we're asking you is for flexibility. First of all, the timing issue. You've got a different timing. We are planning to engage with the schools on how to implement it, the right timing. We want to hear from them. We've set the direction, but we've also heard very firmly that there are some resource issues. We need to understand those, and we pledge to go out and understand them so we don't undermine the schools' ability to implement this or as we've heard earlier, get in the way with other critical goals. So conceptually, I mean, we're on the same page. We've agreed with you. I think we're suggesting that we need to set high standards. We need to set requirements. But again, I think there's a strong case for letting one board take responsibility for this. And if you're not happy with where we're going, tell us, and then obviously you can intervene as you wish at some point. But if we're moving in the right direction, I think it's better to give the responsibility to a board that's in charge with this, spending a lot of time on this with the technical resources behind us to do this as a comprehensive strategy. That would be my answer.
Representative Wisbit.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Both Jerry and Duncan, thank you very much for all your time. I think hopefully I've told you that. I mean, my wife's job is recruiting volunteers, and volunteers are the backbone of everything, and you know you're great, and we need you. Could you please tell me, in a normal student's high school education, how much time, like if they were taking a credit every classroom available, how many credits could they take?
Chair Buckley, Representative Wisnett, members of the committee. It really depends on the school day that each district has. You would have school districts might have an 8-period day. That would be unusual now. Some would have a 7, and there, I believe, if you have a 6-period day. If you had a 6-period day, that would be 6 times 4 years would be 24 units. So there would be 24 units that would be there. Most schools have more than 6 opportunities, but so it varies school to school. So there's that meshing of electives and how many and what are the requirements, and we've tried to look at that statewide of what that does mean for students.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Thank you. Thank you for that response. What the point I'm going at is, like you've said, is so right now, looking at 2012, 2010, we're going to require graduation to be 24 credits. But probably a majority of our students have the opportunity they could pick up 28 or 29 credits during their education. So my point is that I know from personal experience as a parent, I want my kid busy. I mean, playing in sports or taking classes. And what I'm after here is, if we have more time available, I would encourage, I listen to your your comments about, you know, not mandating this, but give you a chance to work it. But I think we're ready. I think the students need these courses. I think they need them now. You know, every year that we don't have an educated student population in the civics, we have weakened our democracy. Every year that we don't have an educated students in financial institutes, we have more people breaking the laws, going bankrupt, getting in financial difficulty. I think we can't wait. I don't think 2 or 3 years past what are we looking at now? 212 in here, so we're talking about 215 before we could introduce civics and economics into our curriculum. So I would encourage response, and hopefully we don't have to wait till that long to introduce these courses, electives, or part of the social sciences three electives that we need now.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisner, I would just stress, right now there are three social studies classes required, and the state standards speak to civics and economics right now. So I think you will find the requirements are in place. The question I think we need to ask ourselves, and again, I encourage you to ask us, and we'll do more research for you. Again, we need to make sure we're within the budget parameters of the department. I understand that, but I think it's a great hot topic, is what can we do, the issues you've been having, to meet those standards through those three classes, because, and I'm convinced it has to do with more active learning, the kinds of discussions you've been having, that you need that kind of hands-on, like the classroom law projects and other such learning that will really engage students in wanting to learn the civics and the economics and so on. And so, but I think I don't think we should wait. I completely agree. We need energy around this issue. But I don't think it's the requirements that are the problem. It's the action on the ground.
Thank you, Chair Buckley. Duncan, and I don't know if you have the research, my concern at having taught at high school level and then, you know, worked at middle school, and Superintendent Castillo has this as one of her top agendas, and that's literacy. The high school class in language arts that I had the proud honor to do was teaching all the students that had failed English 1, 2, and 3 multiple times, and so they were seniors and they had to graduate sometime, Ms. Comp. And so I guess if you anywhere in the research, what level of literacy does a student really need to have by the time they reach 7th grade, 10th grade in order to complete high school? Because part of the interactive model that we're talking about helps children learn even if they don't have the literate skills, the literacy skills. And, you know, I don't even know. They tell me the only thing that I've ever read is that most Americans read at 5th grade level, and that's frightening. But
talk about the lexicon.
Chair Buckley, Representative Comp, members of the committee, I think you just hit upon that we just are not talking about high school graduation requirements. We're talking about every grade level, mm-hmm. and we're talking about taking a look at every individual and seeing what progress they are making towards the diploma. If all you looked at was the sheet, it's not enough. There are school districts in the state of Oregon that are doing unbelievable work regarding taking a look at individual students and individual learners. Forest Grove High School just got an award. I'll speak to that. They basically, at the 8th grade level, if you don't have the basic skills needed to succeed in high school, they have a mandatory summer program, and they have a mandatory program in the high school that you must complete so you're able to be successful in the high school. Those are the local things school districts are doing, addressing the problem. What happens when a student does not learn on the rate we expect them to do? First grade reading level, second grade, third grade, fourth grade. So built throughout this integrated system is intervention strategies so that the learner is identified, techniques are made to help that individual learner. We also are recommending, we also have policies in place, that if a learner learns that sooner, they can go on. I'm an ex-community college person for about 27 years. There's hundreds of 16, 17-year-olds taking community college courses in our community because they have mastered. I mean, they've taken calculus, and they're 16. Where do they go next? There's tons of ways to do that. So we're looking at, we're trying to focus on individual learners, and we're also trying to focus on engaging parents. They don't have parents engaging the students on, this is what you don't know. You need this to be successful. And intervene, help, modify, etc. So it's not just graduation requirements. It's learning steps and identifying that as students go through that process.
And I would just add what Jerry is really talking about, the essential skills. And we just, at the last board meeting, reviewed the, it's funny you should ask this because it was the reading skills and the assessment. And again, we've learned that about where the current standards are against adult literature, both in the workplace and higher ed, and we need to set the very high standard in reading for high school for those young people to go out and be prepared. And we walk that backwards into the elementary and middle schools, and I think as a result we're likely to be raising the expectations in those early years so that when they're hitting the high school years, they're ready to read high school level texts, and that's really, really important. And again, that's part of the process and review process of standards and assessments that we're in the middle of.
Well, it's just that many of my teacher colleagues approach me after last session and they go, how can you, Betty, knowing the challenges that our students face, add another math requirement? Because they aren't meeting the requirements now. And I said, well, you just have to trust that we have the best interests, but I understand what they're saying.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
Chair Buckley, Representative Comp, members of the committee. I've had that same question asked to me from a variety of people that care very much about our students.
Right.
My response as one board member is, do we want to give a person a diploma that doesn't mean anything? Because once they leave that high school and they don't have the skills, essential skills, and what you need as the person to succeed, it doesn't help them very much to be 19 years of age, going out and not having the skills. So that tough intervention with students and with parents regarding how we're doing is what we are asking our educators to do. We're asking and saying, let's be honest. If you can't read, let me help you read. Because I know that if you can't read, you're not going to be able to handle math, you're not going to be able to handle science, you're not going to be able to handle social studies, etc. So there's essential skills, and we need to engage people on the reality. It might mean some students may not get a high school diploma, but then there's options for those students also. And there's a lot more options now than there was 20 years ago of students taking advantage of educational opportunities. But it is a tough one because we care about students. We want them to be successful. But oftentimes we don't say, you can't read. It's kind of tough to be successful in high school.
Thank you.
Representative Dahlin.
Yes, I guess I'm going to talk with Duncan for just a moment, if you don't mind. A thought came to mind, which is totally unrelated to the question. Perhaps we ought to do recalls. Class of 72 missed the understanding of algebra. Bring them back. But Duncan, on a more serious tone, when I get to the civics, and I understand my colleague, Representative Wisnett's frustration, we have had the civics requirement there for how long?
Well, the current version, I believe, is 10 years at least. Okay. But I think we've always had civics requirements. I think we've had different variations. I'm not sure I can give you the history of civics, but a long time.
A long time. And we'll take the 10 years or a long time, either one.
Even longer.
And what I'm trying to do is strike this relationship between the State Board of Ed and the legislative body. And with a 10-year requirement on civics, and then we go back to the Law Project. And the discoveries of the Law Project were startling, to say the least. Those of us that heard, I think we used the example that they didn't know who the legislators were because we were so highly offended we thought everybody knew who we were, but apparently very, very few of them did. But the point is, for 10 years we have had this requirement, and we're not getting there. So the question is, and where I'm going with this, if the State Board of Ed is addressing this now, or if the State Board of has addressed this very recently, I am very, very willing to leave the State Board in charge by virtue of the vetting you do. But when I hear a contradiction of terms that we've had a statute or a standard for 10 years and it is still not accomplishing anything, then as a legislator, and it is with great consternation that I get in and muck around, but with 10 years of opportunity, I then am willing to start mucking around.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dahlem, actually, I've got a little personal history here. First of all, there have been credit requirements in social studies for much longer than 10 years. I don't know. Certainly when I was in high school. And when I was in high school, as on the newspaper, I gave a survey. I was curious of this very same question. A survey very much like the one that we delivered to young adults most in this recent project we did with the Classroom Rock Project. And I will tell you, about 20% of the high school students at Woodrow Wilson High School in Portland, Oregon knew who Senator Hatfield and Senator Packwood were. This is not a new issue. and I am totally, and I was passionate then, I'm still passionate about this issue. I've not been on the state board that long, but I think there's something wrong with civics education. So I want to stress, I'm not suggesting that you are not onto a big issue in Oregon. I'm just suggesting to say that a half credit of economics and a half credit of civics, when we already have three social studies credits required and the standards include civics and economics, that isn't the problem. And so if you're convinced that there's a problem, then I think you do need to ask the state board and the department, what can we do as a state to improve the education in civics in Oregon? And I think you should expect a report back from us in 2009 with a work plan and a set of recommendations. I think it's a completely reasonable issue to be raising through the legislature and your committee if you're not satisfied with the level of education. So I think we're in passionate agreement on the issue in front of you, and it's just a question of how to drive change.
Representative Greenlee.
I'd really like to follow on that, because I did comment earlier on the separation of powers, and I wasn't thinking about this example, but this is an important example. I mean, we can pass a law, we can pass any law we want, and that's fine. But the question is, if civics education is a problem, are we going to change any of the dynamics at all by passing a law saying civics ought to be required? It's already required. Are we going to, if science education is a problem, are we going to change anything at all by passing a law that says science is required, because you've already decided to require science? And, I mean, if I thought passing a law was magic, oh, it's a magic wand, we pass that, solve the problem, it's over. The fact is, the problem is, we're not providing enough resources to the schools so they can do the job they do, and we continue to starve the schools. So they're going from 8-day sessions to 7-day sessions to 6-day sessions. They're cutting out the number of days in a classroom, because after Measure 5, we're not giving them enough money, enough resources to do what they want. We can talk all we want about priorities. Okay, so we'll have a priority between teaching civics or teaching vocational ed for kids who aren't going to college. And I mean, I just don't see how passing a law gets us any further at all in this issue, when the problem is we're not providing the resources we need for our schools to do the kind of things they need to do. So, I mean, if I were convinced passing this law would solve the problem, we pass civics, every graduate from 2012 on is going to be fully educated and engaged in civics. They're going to vote. They're going to say, oh, I love to pay taxes because I know it's my civic responsibility. I mean, fine, pass the law. But the fact is, if we're worried about this, and if we're worried about whether we're producing students that can meet the world competition, the data are very clear. The difference between us and other places in the world is we don't have enough face time with teachers and students. And if we want them to compete with the Japanese and the German and the students from Singapore and from Korea and everywhere else, get the resources in so we can create a match so that our teachers have a fighting chance to spend the time with those students to be able to teach them. And, I mean, I just wonder what we're up to. I wish I had a magic wand to solve the problem. Well, I don't believe passing a law is the magic wand.
That's an excellent comment. Did you care to respond, gentlemen, or just want to leave that as it is? An excellent comment right there. Thank you both very
thank
much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for your work and for your testimony.
Quick close on this. Though. We would love the opportunity to go through the full diploma with you for your feedback and sometime this session. I know this is going to be a topic that you'll be back with when you come to the. There's a number of other bills, but if you at any point would like, you know, to really give us feedback, we would greatly appreciate it.
I think that would be excellent, Mr. Weisson. And I also think that again, do we actually need to pass legislation to look into civics? I mean, that's something we can discuss.
Sure.
I do appreciate the information and appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
We do have a representative from OEA and OSBA here who we pulled the sign-up sheets before everyone could sign up. I don't know if there's any initial comments from either or both. You'd be welcome. And there might be some other folks too. We can go for about another 10 minutes still.
Chair Buckley and members of the committee, my name is Beth Ann Darby, and I'm with the Oregon Education Association. And I've been sitting and listening. I'm sorry, I was too late to make the sign-up sheets, but I was able to hear most of the speakers today. And I was trying to think about, well, what do I have to add to this conversation? Because we really covered the gambit. From OEA's perspective, it really is about the funding and the resource issue, both professional resources and financial resources. I think I'm just going to tell you a little story about what happened in the last legislative session when we discussed some of these requirements, and then I'll be done. It happened to be on a day when I had a bunch of members here from Eugene, and one of my more active involved members, some of you may know him, James Matisse, was here, and he is a social studies teacher at a high school in Eugene. I'm sorry, I don't remember exactly which one. And the personal finance bill was up, and he was passionate in his anger, I think, to a certain degree, because he would love to teach personal finance. He was hired to teach that when he first became a teacher. And now he doesn't teach personal finance. He doesn't teach economics, the things that he was hired at his high school to share, the subject areas he was hired to share with students. Instead, he teaches social studies. And this curriculum is embedded within the broad range of social studies, and he gets a few weeks a year to help share with students everything they need to know to prepare them for life. And it really is a funding issue. We, you know, if we want to make these requirements, we need to make sure that we're ready to have the expertise in the classroom. We need to make sure that we have the time available. We need to make sure that we have the financial resources available to ensure that classrooms have everything they need for students to be successful in these areas. So our members are very concerned about these very same issues. We very much want students to be prepared to become adults that are engaged in civics, that know how to work their checkbooks, who have a basic understanding of science, math, and English and reading. But it's a resource issue. And you hear that from us all the time. We hate always saying that. It's very disturbing to feel like we have to oppose, you know, good ideas because there's no money available to fully implement them.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, David Williams with the Oregon School Boards Association, and I got to say, one of the few times this session you'll hear me say this, that I agree with my colleague from the OEA.
It happens more than that.
All the time.
That as we look to record levels of funding this biennium, $6.3 billion will provide a lot of opportunity for students around the state. But lest we be lulled into complacency, let's keep in mind that $6.3 billion represents 80% of the quality education model. And the quality education model, when fully implemented, has full curriculum on things like science and civics and economics and other things like full-day kindergarten, lower class sizes, etc. But we're not there. We're not at 100%. We're at 80%. And so you end up with a situation in schools where choices have to be made about what areas are we going to focus on. By and large, some of those choices have been taken out of the hands of our local boards through things like No Child Left Behind. And some of those things have been taken out of the purview of the State Board of Ed as the appropriate decision body for our state curriculum. Again, things like No Child Left Behind and other state mandates that we've imposed upon our local jurisdictions. You heard compelling testimony from one of my members earlier, Amy Amrine from Ashland, about the fact that even in a $6.3 billion environment, they're losing $500,000 because of declining enrollment. So I just can't echo enough how much resources drive the debate about the offerings we're giving to students in schools around the state. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Westland, did you care to testify on this issue, or did you just come to the
He doesn't even know what we're talking about.
Mr. Chair, in my years of legislative service, I have yet to find a bill that more comprehensively addresses...
I'm so sorry.
I don't think he's identified
I'd be
himself.
Happy to answer any questions.
Chair, I don't think he identified himself.
Thank goodness. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think as a committee... And I think we've had some good testimony today. But I still think, and I'm getting the sense that the chair and the committee don't want to force this or put it on the Board of Education. But I still think there's how many electives in social studies? There's three electives in social studies. So I guess geography, could be civics. I just think these are things that they're important to young people. So if we don't direct them to take these courses, they're going to take something that's not going to help them as be good citizens. It's not going to help them to be financially responsible or knowledgeable enough to keep themselves out of trouble or bankruptcy or whatever. So I still think I would encourage the chair and the committee to think about that. A bill could still say of those three electives, you know, we encourage you, if nothing else, that take civics and economics, financial management. And I think there used to be a requirement, Representative Dallum, or
there used to be, or still is, to teach civics. I'm sure, but I didn't have that written, and that's why I asked Duncan. There's always been a requirement to teach civics. Of course, I think the question...
No, I thought the financial management. I thought there was financial management.
Personal,
no,
I think that's
coming
a
requirement.
Though. That has gone.
Yeah. That's gone away. It was in there.
I mean, if you look at that stuff on the back, on the back of that graph that has all the different requirements,
yeah,
it talks about what skills are needed.
That's where
these come in. So I mean, there is a skill issue about making sure that they can balance checkbooks and things like that. It's just
how they're doing it.
It's just how they get about it.
I think that the combination of credit by proficiency and essential skills is a fantastic step forward.
So again, Mr. Chair and committee members, I would encourage this group to maybe we could think about going to a work session with the Board of Education or something to put in there. I think that we could encourage them to do this or to encourage the students to do this or something.
Representative Lynn.
Yes, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Just want to make some comment on it. Duncan Wise and he eloquently spoke of his position, but at the same time, he mentioned he doesn't have any formal position on this issue. At the same time, what I'm hearing, don't do it, we are doing it. Actually, he expressed his position opposing this science bill or the civic or economy. And then, State Board of Education at the same time requiring the 3 years of science, and then we don't want us to require them to do exactly what they did. So it seems to me some contradiction, and then I'm somewhat perplexed and puzzled on this issue. But I understand where they're coming from, but I thought I expressed my sentiment on the issue. And so maybe take some consideration.
Very good. Representative Rubin.
I'll throw my comment in here. I really do believe that this is a state board issue, and they should be taking the lead on it. I don't have any problem having a meeting with the state board to talk about some of those things. My issue is that, you know, we here have these debates often about local control or not local control. And this is really a local control issue. We have set the standards. We've told people what we expect, and we expect school boards and superintendents and principals to implement these skills. And if so, unless we're going to go out and do the work for them, and basically, I mean, as Representative Greenlick said, you know, passing a bill isn't going to change anything. The issue is they have everything they need to be doing this right now in those school districts, and they have for a long time. And it comes down to the will of the individual school boards and the individual communities how much is going to be expected. We can point out to them what they haven't done, as was done by this nice project report. And hopefully they will start getting the point that that's probably not what we want. And they may want to think about that before we start implementing policies that say, here's the curriculum you have. We had a superintendent tell us they don't want us to tell us the curriculum. But until you tell them the curriculum, unless the school districts are going to manage it, unless we give them the money they need to do it with, I mean, it's still, in our state, we've still chosen to have local control be a part of this whole process. And every time we make and do one of these things, we erode that local control about what is civics that they want to do in their government. I am adamant, and I, for 25 years, have been on the board of Youth and Government, who was just here last weekend with a whole bunch of kids, and I was a math teacher, but being involved in government was really important, so I brought kids here every year, and we pushed it. It is still something that I think we can do as a group, and we can push them, but passing this law is not going to change that, in my opinion. We had it on the books before, and it, as people, who was it, Duncan said, at his school, they didn't do much better a few years ago. It was just a few years ago. When we did it at our district, it was a lot longer ago when I was in high school, and we didn't do very well either.
Mr. West, would you be willing to meet with me at some time to talk over some proposals that might address some of the things you brought up in your testimony that might address the concerns that the committee has? I greatly appreciate that. Representative Dunn, do you have any final words?
No, I think you covered it quite nicely.
All right.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to hear from the educational superintendent office on this subject also sometime in the future if we have time.
Very good. Very good. I'm sure they would be glad to. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bills 2510, 2046, and 2045, and adjourn the committee hearing on House Committee of Education for February 19th. Thank you very much.